done this meeting. Other Division on Crime Victims and Criminal Records is called to order. First order of business, we've got House File 2845, Representative Downey, judges authorized to prohibit juvenile sex offenders from residing near their victims. This, members, was posted as an informational hearing. Representative Downey will present the bill without testifiers, but will rely on House research to do a walkthrough and explain how the bill fits into existing statutes. Ms. Perius and Ms. Diebel are prepared to comment if asked. What's that?
Mr. Diebel.
What did I say?
Yes.
Miss, sorry, Jeff. That's rough. No, he's definitely a Mr. You have copies of the bill in your packets. We were scheduling this earlier, but Representative Downey did ask for additional time to cover some details. This hearing today also is being televised, members. So, Representative Downey, I will move your bill 2845 for consideration, this being an informational hearing only. No action will be taken on it. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for coming in on a Friday. I know this is your regularly scheduled committee day, but we're getting late in session, so I appreciate the chance to present this bill. I'm actually coming to you not as anybody with expertise in this area. I don't have any professional background. I'm not an attorney. I don't have any experience really in the courts. Thankfully, I've never had to deal with this on a personal level either. So really, I'm coming to you today on behalf of a family in my district who unfortunately did have to deal with this kind of experience. And frankly, I think like everybody in the room, I'm just coming to you as a human being and a father, somebody who can really relate to the circumstances of this family. And I want to make sure, I heard comments before about this being a very deliberative committee, and I want to make sure that we present this not in a sensational way or as a cause celebre, frankly, the family's interest, not putting their child on the stand and not coming to testify today, I think is evidence that they're exercising good, sober judgment as well, and they feel like they ran into a loophole, a little bit of a loophole, at least an information gap from their perspective as they were going through sentencing guidelines and figuring out their plea arrangement. And so this bill here attempts to kind of close that loophole. Let me just give a little bit of background. I'm not going to go into extreme detail on the personal circumstances. I'm sure you hear lots of extreme details and can fill in plenty of the gaps here. But I'll give a brief intro and then ask Mr. Diebel, if you would, to give a walkthrough on the bill and just explain how this fits into statute and the sentencing guidelines. So I was approached by a family in my district who had the horrible circumstance of having a young daughter. I'm going to be somewhat vague in the details intentionally. It's not their interest to kind of be identified here. A young daughter, young elementary school daughter, who was sexually abused in case of evidence and other circumstantial evidence to the first degree, and then plea bargained to a second degree conviction. They live right next door to the perpetrator, to the offender, and upon completing his rehabilitation term as part of the plea agreement, was placed right back in the home next door, literally just feet across the property line. And as things unfolded and the family came to the full experience of what it meant to have their next-door neighbor who had literally raped their child be placed back in the home next door to them and realized the impact on their family and on their daughter out in the yard and going to the bus stop in the morning right next to the person who had victimized them have been compelled to seek some action to try and spare other families from this. So the real intention here is to try and close a loophole, and it may not actually be a sentencing guideline loophole, but it was certainly a loophole in the way their case was processed, and we're guessing others as well. So the language is intended to be permissive, but to have something in statute so that a family going through the plea bargaining situation would actually know that they do have an option as part of their plea arrangement to prohibit the offender from living within 1,000 feet, or in another case here, some alternate language within three city blocks of the victim. So the intention here is to make sure that this is clearly spelled out in statute, that this is an option available in sentencing, that the victim's family going through a plea arrangement, you know, discussion would be fully aware of that, and that it would be clear that that's an option available to them as they go through this. In this case, the family did not know that that was an opportunity, and in fact, as part of their process, didn't really feel like they had that kind of option at all. So with that, let me try and hand it off to Mr. Diebel, who can explain the bill. It's a pretty straightforward bill, but I'm sure it's complex in terms of the way it interacts with existing law.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill would authorize a juvenile court judge to impose a residency restriction on a juvenile who's been adjudicated delinquent for a first or second degree criminal sexual conduct offense. As Representative Downey mentioned, it would allow the judge to limit the person from living within 1,000 feet or three city blocks, whichever is greater, as long as the court has jurisdiction over the offender. There is a provision in Section 1 that touches on one of the sticky issues in juvenile law, in that the law is designed to rehabilitate the juvenile, and they look for the best interest of the offender. And that would, in most cases, probably be putting the person back in with their family after they complete their treatment or whatever restrictions are placed on their liberties. But in this case, you have the person going right back to the location that's near the victim. So they put in, the reviser added a clause in this bill that said that the judge does not need to explain why placing the residency restriction on the juvenile offender is in his best interest, because clearly there'd be quite a few instances where they'd probably want the person to go back to the family and his parents, but rather than making the judge have to explain why this is in the best interest of the juvenile, they've excused the judge from that requirement, and which is runs somewhat contrary to the general theme of juvenile justice, and that is rehabilitation of the juvenile offender. And in this case, they're weighing the victim's rights more than protecting the victim as opposed to protecting the juvenile offender. If I can add a little bit more, as for adults, there's a nationwide wave. I think it's ebbed recently, but to put residency restrictions on sex offenders. There have been cities and even states. Iowa has residency restrictions placed on all adult and I assume actually juvenile offenders with living within school range of schools, daycares, and whatnot. That wave has decreased. I think Florida has sought to limit their the scope of that because they have people living under bridges and that. So it's the public policy of this is if you have a wide scale policy of having people not having homes and living homeless versus being able to monitor them as a predatory offender. Minnesota does not have a statewide. There are some cities that have citywide ordinances that prevent sex offenders from living within near schools. But that's the extent of Minnesota law on it as far as I'm aware.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could maybe just add a couple of comments and then open it up to questions if members have them. You know, this family really is trying hard not to sensationalize this and to try and find a reasonable, appropriate solution to what they experienced. But I do want to put a little bit of a personal face on this, and I'm sure this committee hears lots of stories. But in this particular case, when your family has gone through the circumstance of discovering this as the events were occurring upstairs with a neighbor family that they trusted and a neighbor young man that they trusted, to go through the whole process of discovery, to go through that as a family and to watch their young elementary school daughter go through that and to realize just the horrible circumstance that puts the victim and the victim's family in. And then after all of the court proceedings and being thrown into a world that you never, ever wanted or anticipated being thrown into, and then going through all of that, making the best decision that you can, actually thinking about what's best for that boy as well, and just trying to do the right thing by all parties concerned, and then not really fully understanding that when that boy gets returned literally next door and goes out to the bus stop for the first day of school, and your daughter, your elementary school daughter, has to walk down the driveway and go to the bus stop right next to that rapist's bus stop, it hit home. It hits home in a big way. And you know, you do your best to cope, but after months and months of that, you know what, it really takes its toll. So I want to present some of that personal side of this, not so that we somehow make a rash judgment or pass a bill with, you know, somebody's name on it or anything, but to just understand, you know, this is happening all over the place. And if there's a way that we can just give a little extra piece of leverage to the victim's family, and I know, having talked with many of the advocacy groups and things since being presented with this from my constituent, you know, there's a bit of a bias, as Mr. Diebel said, towards rehabilitation that, unfortunately, to the average person, the average dad, such as myself and this family, feels like the victim ends up getting punished, and not the other way around. And I'm not so sure, nor is this family, that punishment doesn't have a rehabilitative effect, and nobody's trying to put people in circumstances where they can't recover and become, you know, good, normal, producing people in society. But in this particular case, it does seem like there's one opportunity here in statute to put this in, to give families and victims a little bit of leverage. So I want to make sure that people have a sense for the intensity of the circumstance, and I know you all know that and can feel that as people, and the fact that this family is just not trying to do anything rash or reactive, but really to try and make a positive contribution to statute and sentencing that would spare other families from that circumstance. So with that, I'll just pause and attempt to respond to questions, or I know somebody wants to testify as well. We can proceed as you see fit, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Downey. And before we move to testimony from other stakeholders, Representative Olin, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, it's not a question, but it is a comment on the situation. First, I'd like to thank Representative Downey for actually bringing an issue that probably does need some better solution, and I don't necessarily know the answer, but I will indicate that as a former county attorney of 32 years who handled all the juvenile cases in Pennington County, I'm well aware of this problem, and it's been one we've tore apart this system or tore apart our brains trying to think of an answer to handle it. In fact, I would go so far as to say in some cases the worst case scenario is even a worse one than you. Yours is horrible, don't get me wrong, but there's even a worse situation when it's inside the house itself. And man, that one's driven me nuts trying to figure out a foolproof answer for that. But this problem is one that really does require that the system, now that it's been brought forward as well as you have by statute and willingness to do so, does have to sit down and take a serious look at. And when I say the system, I don't just mean the prosecutors, the county attorneys themselves, or probation, social services, defense, guardian ad litem, judges, in the entire system, anybody else related to that system, has to try to figure out what do we do in this situation. So I appreciate the fact you brought this bill, and hopefully somewhere we can find an answer, because I'm 32 years as a county attorney. I've never really solidly figured out how to handle some of these situations.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Thank you, Representative Downey. We'll move to testimony from members of the public. Ms. Haas, please. Representative Loon, you had a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, well, first, I'd just like to associate myself actually with the comments of Representative Olin and just complimenting you, Representative Downey, for bringing this forward. I'm sure even from your constituent standpoint, coming to a public official and sort of bearing that situation couldn't have been easy, you know, I want to thank you for having the city or the committee consider this. Just a couple of questions and more just for whoever may be appropriate to answer, because I'm not an attorney or well-versed in this area of the law. But with regards to maybe this situation or typically, would a juvenile offender of this time spend some time outside of the family, incarcerated or in treatment in that, before going back into the home, or could they be immediately placed back in the home
when
this occurs?
Mr. Chair, I can describe this circumstance, and maybe the testifiers or the members of the committee could kind of say more broadly what the circumstances are. But yes, this individual did spend time away from home in rehabilitation for a period of months over the summer, and then was placed back into the home.
Okay.
Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could continue. Just currently, does the court have some discretion to apply perhaps this requirement as part of a plea agreement? Is this something that perhaps the family who had the little girl's family, could they have asked for this? Does the court have the ability to grant this now, or is this legislation trying to address the fact that the court does not have this type of authority currently?
Representative Downey.
You know, I'll let one of the, I'll let Nancy or Mr. Representative Olin answer. They probably can give a more comprehensive answer.
Ms. Haas, why don't you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer, here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I'll get to your question, but just let me say for the record, the County Attorneys Association has not taken a position on this bill. Our Juvenile Law Committee has reviewed it. I think the change from the way that we originally saw the draft was the court shall prohibit the child from residing, and now it's may, and we think that that moves in the right direction. Our position really is that the court did have the ability to do this now, and so this language isn't necessary to affect that outcome in the future. However, you know, we have tried to spend some time, you know, with Representative Downey thinking about and understanding the situation that his constituent has gone through, and trying to propose some ideas to address it in the future. And you know, the one idea that we came up with was maybe having the court think about the best interests of the victim. You know, that's something that we have thought about and conversed with Representative Downey about. But as Representative Olin said, you know, this is something that judges have the authority to do now, and it's just a matter of the individual circumstance. And as Council Diebel mentioned, you know, there is the juvenile system is designed to focus on rehabilitating the juvenile, and so we're kind of at a crossroads with an issue like this.
Mr. Chair, if I could maybe just add one thing.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've got to be careful, because I wasn't in the plea bargaining meetings, and I'm passing on information that's been related to me, but my sense and my understanding is that there are kind of differences in practice, maybe county to county, even, you know, judge to judge perhaps. And in this particular case, the family really didn't understand that they had this kind of an option available to them in their plea bargaining, and I think it was maybe specific to the fact that they were plea bargaining from first degree to second degree. And, you know, first degree implies certain things on the family if you're going to go ahead and, you know, kind of prosecute to that extent. And they just weren't prepared, didn't feel that it was worth it for their family and their daughter to put their daughter on the stand and go through that. And so had they known that this were an option available to them in their plea bargaining sessions, they might have taken different stands or different positions. And so I don't want to say it's simply an awareness level issue for the victim as they are going through the plea bargaining process, but it's at least that. And so this statute attempts to address that informational, just awareness level for the victim's family, and perhaps even putting it in statute might give it a little more prominence as compared to having individual, you know, district court or court practices drive this. Maybe this would be a more front and center thing that would be available to families irrespective of where they are or what court they're in.
Let me add also, Representative Loon, with respect to Representative Downey's bill on the subject matter of how we deal with this is a separate issue. I think as to the question of whether or not we should pursue legislation that's already technically available under common law, it's a different story. I've carried bills before that have expressly made provisions allowing a court to do something which technically they already have to do under other statutes. But oftentimes, in order to affect public policy change, you need to put express language in the statutes so that the judges are educated and feel like they're able to do it. There are many judges oftentimes that are hesitant to do something new or bold that from a public policy perspective we up here have to consider from testifiers from the public that they don't get on the bench. So I think there can be times where you can legitimately bring up a bill that may already be available. There would be available remedies, but that we just got to put it in statute and say, hey, by the way, the legislature says you can really do this. Thereby, the judges are less likely to be concerned about being overturned on appeal or looking goofy because they went ahead and did it. Representative Hillstrom, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Representative Downey for bringing this issue up as well. When I first started in the legislature, I actually carried the bills that said you couldn't live within so many feet of a playground, a daycare center, a park, all of those kinds of things. And then the Department of Corrections mapped everywhere that sex offenders couldn't live, and there was like three blocks in the state they all would have to have lived. So I didn't have great success with that proposal, and ultimately, the advocates, even of victims of these assaults, said they want to know where these folks are. And so thank you for bringing this issue forward. I'm certain there will be lots of discussion going forward about this issue and seeing if we can't come up with some sort of solution.
Representative Loon, did you have another comment?
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just actually, you your comments actually echoed what I was going to mention, that in previous bills before this committee, you have commented about, while the statute may allow currently the bench to make these decisions, sometimes we have to, really highlight it for them in the law and, indicate that this is something that perhaps they should be doing. And I do think there needs to be a recognition of or a better balancing of the victim's interest in full recovery for the victim along with the rehabilitation of the offender. Those should be given equal attention in this situation. One last question, and I think I know the answer, but Representative Downey, do you know, is there any fiscal impact that you're aware of to this?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, thank you. Yeah, actually, I had a note here to make mention of that because this does not have a fiscal impact. So,
impressive, Representative Downey. Everything else that comes through here does.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While it may not have a state fiscal note, in the event that these folks are not permitted to go back to live with their families, there may be a fiscal note in terms of them being out of home placement or those kinds of expenses related to the county. And so those are definitely discussions that should be had as well.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Haas?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up on one other point that Representative Loon asked about and Representative Downey mentioned about the family being able to request the restriction at the plea bargaining stage. I want to make sure that I mention on the record that, a family could ask for that, but at the end of the day, it's ultimately up to the judge to accept that. So it is a two-part process.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify on House File 2845? Okay. There being no other testimony on this, this concludes the informational portion of House File 2845. Thank you for your work on this, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
For the other work of the committee, members, this is, again, our last meeting, unless a bill gets sent back, right, Representative Hillstrom, untimely ripped from the House floor, as it were. So I want to thank the folks that helped out on committee, including Vice Chair Szymanski, who is excused today, who's not here, but also Ms. Perius and Mr. Diebel. Kate Weeks and Andy Gilday have been very helpful with House DFL. research and House GOP research, as well as the committee page, Charlie Mulberg, thank you, Charlie, and Aaron Hubert and Patrick Baldwin, committee staff. I also want to thank Nancy Conley for filling in a pinch. That being said, committee's adjourned. Oh, Representative Loon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, I guess as a representative from the other side of the aisle here today, join you in your thanks to all of the members and the staff, and also thank you really on behalf of my colleague, Representative Downey, for gathering us together for this today. You didn't have to do that, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Committee's adjourned.